Hello, men. We are beginning tonight the back half of the fall portion of our Gospel of Mark study, and I'm excited to look at this passage with you guys tonight. I know this week will be a little bit unusual, but excited to dive into this section nonetheless. So this is a section of Mark, which is actually probably one of my personal favorites. This is a unit, Mark 4:35 to 5:43, with a very clear and discernible theme, which is that of Jesus' authority. And we're going to look at four scenes here in Mark's gospel. And each of these scenes deals with situations that are hopeless, situations that deal with impossible difficulties that seem to not be able to be overcome. And it's the very hopelessness of each of these situations that serve to highlight Jesus' authority, to highlight just how powerful he is. And so I'm excited to dive in. Let's go ahead and start with this very first scene. We're going to begin in Mark 4, verse 35. And this first scene we're looking at comes on the heels of Jesus teaching the parables, which we looked at 2 weeks ago. So we saw at the beginning of Mark 4 that Jesus had been teaching crowds these parables from a boat. And then here in verse 35, he tells his disciples, let's go over to the other side, being the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And this might be a familiar story to you. It is to me. I've got a kid's book that I read to my children about this very story. But there's an interesting fact that I think Mark alone brings out that I've never noticed. And this is kind of a cool, fun fact. In verse 36, Mark writes, there's other boats with them. When I've heard this story, I've only ever imagined that it's just Jesus and his followers in this one boat that are in danger. And yet it appears there's other boats. I never really thought about, hey, are there other people experiencing this same storm? And Mark seems to suggest there were, which is kind of cool. Anyway, on the Sea of Galilee, where they are, sudden violent storms are a very real possibility. It's not unheard of in this location. And that's exactly what happens in this scene. So they're setting sail to go across the other side. And very suddenly, a storm pops up out of nowhere. And remember, some of these guys are experienced fishermen, some of Jesus' disciples. And why that's important, the reason I mention that is because just imagine this. Imagine you're on an airplane that hits a bit of turbulence. And let's say the pilot comes on and it's like, hey, a bit of turbulence, no big deal. It's going to calm you down, right? Well, let's imagine you're on an airplane with a bit of turbulence and then the pilot starts panicking. What do you do when the pilot starts to panic? That is your cue to panic as well, right? So if these experienced fishermen are freaking out, then there's a good bet that this situation is very bleak. This is a dangerous storm. These experienced fishermen are panicking. As I mentioned earlier, this is a hopeless case. All right, and so they wake Jesus up, and there's reproach in their voice. They're wondering how Jesus could have possibly led them into this kind of situation. How could he be sleeping? They say, teacher, don't you care if we drown? And Jesus, we see his response. He gets up, and he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, quiet, be still. And then the wind died down and it was completely calm. That's verse 39. The next verse, he said to his disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? And maybe you picked up on this as you read this section of Mark. Pay attention, though, to how often faith and fear show up in these verses, in these different scenes. They are contrasted. They are mutually exclusive. They show up often together. And the disciples, it's funny, they might even be more freaked out by what they saw Jesus do than they were by the storm itself. And because you see them here at the end of the scene, they ask the question, which again is a major theme of Mark's gospel, which is, who is this? Who is this guy? If you and I saw this happen, if we were in the scene, you know, we'd probably be asking the same question. Who is this guy who can do what we just saw him do? There's another level to this, though. They just watched Jesus do something that was undoubtedly impressive, but they also just watched Jesus do something that, according to the Old Testament, only God can do, which is still the sea and the wind. Mark writes that Jesus rebuked the wind and silenced the waves. And there's a lot of Old Testament examples that kind of show how only God is allowed to do that. I want to mention just two. Psalm 106, verse 9, reflecting on the Exodus, says that God rebuked the Red Sea. And then in Isaiah 50, verse 2, God says that by a mere rebuke, I dry up the sea. It is God's prerogative to rebuke waters. And Jesus just did that. And so in this short section, Mark shows us that Jesus has authority over nature, which, again, as readers of Mark's gospel, Mark is wanting us to ask the same question. Who is this guy? that he can control nature. So they come to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Here we get our second scene, where they land on the shore and a demon-possessed man runs up to Jesus. He approaches Jesus. And I want to draw your attention. I know this is a question in the workbook. Look at how Mark describes this guy in the first few verses of Mark chapter 5. Mark seems to go out of his way describing just how strong this guy is. Did you notice this? He writes, no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. He says that he had often been chained, hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. And then he says that no one was strong enough to subdue him. And Mark's point is to underscore, once again, how hopeless this man's condition is. No one has been able to restrain him. This man is bent on self-destruction and mutilation. He's hopeless. And he's been resigned to a life of isolation, living among these tombs. So he's showing the desperation of this man. He's also showing you, I think, what kind of challenge Jesus is up against here. The challenge is this. So we've already seen Jesus cast out a demon from a guy in Mark 1 in the synagogue. We've read general comments about him casting out demons. Here, what's unique about this particular scene, though, is that Jesus is not just facing one demon, he's facing an army of them. And the reason for this guy's strength seems to lie in the fact that apparently there are thousands of demons at work in this guy. And by highlighting just how strong this guy is, Mark is probably wanting us to remember the strong man that he mentioned back in chapter 3, verse 27. Back there, Jesus compared himself to someone who had overpowered a strong man, who's Satan, and plundered his house. And right here in this scene, we are seeing that truth enacted. And so these demons sense a threat in Jesus. And by naming him some son of the Most High God, they're probably trying to overpower him. They're confronting him. And so as readers, after we've just watched the forces of nature obey Jesus, we now see Jesus face off against an army of demons. He faces off against a man that Mark has shown us no one is able to overcome. And the crazy thing is, Jesus not just wins, but easily wins. There's no contest here. Now, there's some ambiguities in this text. We don't know why the demons were so concerned to remain in that region. Mark doesn't really seem concerned to explain why. We don't know why they would see entering pigs as an acceptable alternative to leaving the region. We don't know why Jesus allowed them to enter the pigs in the first place. And some people get upset. Why does Jesus allow these 2,000 pigs to be destroyed? And yeah, I think the answer to that question is not that pigs were not valuable. I think the point is that human life is much more valuable. This is an image bearer of God, and we see that demons are bent on destroying those who bear the image of God. One commentator about this passage wrote that a human life is seen here as more important than a herd of pigs. And another one said this, that Jesus teaches his disciples that the deliverance of one man is worth 2,000 pigs and more. And here you again see faith and fear, that interplay of faith and fear at work. So this man is healed. They just watched the pigs drown. People go to town and report what happened. And the people come and check it out. They see this guy who had been formerly uncontrollable sitting down, dressed, and in his right mind at Jesus' feet. And they were afraid, verse 15 says. Now, why were they afraid? A couple possibilities here. There might have been an economic impact from losing all these pigs, which is a very real possibility. Maybe they were just freaked out about having a guy as powerful as Jesus living among them. He's obviously powerful, but they don't know who this guy is. Who knows what he's capable of? As I read the reaction in verses 14 to 17, I'm also sad for this guy that Jesus just healed. The people in town are so upset about the pig, no one's like rejoicing about this guy being healed. One commentator said this, that this is the most alienated person to appear so far in Mark's gospel. And the people who came to see what had happened were more concerned about the death of the pigs than about his restoration. They felt no joy at the release of an oppressed man. Really makes me feel sad for the man. As for the guy himself, so they beg Jesus to leave. They say, you're out of here. Please leave. And Jesus obeyed. He listens to them, and he does. As for the man himself, he begs to follow Jesus. Jesus tells him no. Rather, he tells him to go to his home and tell the people what Jesus has done for the man. The man wanted to be with Jesus, the text says. This is the same language Mark used in chapter 3, verse 14, when Jesus appoints 12 disciples to be with him. So what's happening is this man is asking to be a disciple of Jesus. And so Jesus tells him no, which is kind of strange. He tells him no so that the man can go home and talk about what had just happened. And the reason I say that's strange is that usually in Mark's gospel so far, Jesus tells people to be silent about what they've seen him do. So why does Jesus tell this man to be vocal about what he's seen Jesus do? That's kind of unusual. I think the simplest explanation for this is that Jesus is not in Jewish territory here. He's in Gentile territory. The fact that there's pig herders explains this, I think. Pigs were unclean to Jews, so you would not have pig herders among a Jewish territory. And so, and in Jewish territories, we've seen Jesus be very careful about his identity because of the danger of having people misunderstand. So, you know, if people in a Jewish territory are going around talking about Jesus being the Messiah, well, that's true. Jesus is God's Messiah. He's the anointed one. But in many people's mind in Jewish areas, they had this misperception of what a Messiah would be. The Messiah would be this military ruler, they thought, who was going to drive out Rome. So if Jesus is going around talking about himself being the Messiah, they're going to think he's going to stir up a rebellion against Rome. So they understood Messiah in very nationalistic terms, which was not Jesus' purpose to drive out Rome at the time. So, but there's really not that threat of misunderstanding this Gentile region. And so Jesus tells this man to be a witness in this own area, his own area. And he listens to Jesus. He obeys. He goes to tell people what Jesus did for him. And the people were amazed, Mark 5, verse 20 says, at what he said. And what's interesting, I won't spoil this, but a little later on in Mark's gospel, he's going to return to this region. And I think we get a little bit more of a window into what kind of success or impact this man probably had in his region. That's going to be a little bit later on. But so we've seen Jesus has authority over nature. We've seen that he has authority over demons. And that brings us to this last narrative, which is really two distinct scenes. We get another Mark sandwich here where Mark splits a scene in two and inserts another one in the middle. So Jesus has gone back across the sea, and he's immediately approached by a synagogue ruler, Jairus. And what's interesting, when I read this passage a little while ago, I was struck by how concerned Mark seems to be to understand, to let us know that this is a synagogue ruler. He keeps mentioning that he is in charge of a synagogue. Maybe Jairus is in charge of one of the synagogues Jesus had been to previously in Mark's gospel. Either way, he knows who Jesus is. He knows what Jesus can do. And this is significant because, remember, Jesus is not on the best term with the synagogues at this point. Jewish rulers hate him. We've seen that they want to kill him. That Jairus came to him at all shows his desperation. And even if Jairus didn't personally hate Jesus, maybe thought he was a good guy, seeking help from Jesus is probably not going to win him any favors from his colleagues. It's probably frowned upon from other people in the synagogue. And yet we see him just put aside whatever pride he may have had. We see him ask Jesus to heal his daughter who is at the point of death. And so Jesus agrees and they take off toward his house. And then on the way, we get a large crowd following Jesus. And Mark introduces us to a woman. This woman has a disease that, like leprosy, makes her to be permanently unclean, bars her from the religious life of Israel, and effectively makes her an outcast in society. And once again, this is another hopeless situation. So she's had this condition for 12 years. She has depleted all of her resources on doctors trying to be cured. And not only has she not been cured, she's actually gotten worse. So she's suffering physically, she's broke, and she is a social outcast. She is desperate, and so she's hopeless. She has nothing to lose. She has heard of Jesus and decides to push through the crowd to touch Jesus' clothes. She's probably operating on a belief popular at the time that a person's power and honor was transferred to the clothes they would wear, and so she figures, man, if I can just touch his cloak as he passes by, I'm good. And so that's exactly what she does. She touches his cloak, and immediately she knows, she senses her body has been healed. And then Jesus senses this too. He senses power has gone out from him. And so he stops and asks who touched him. And I love this scene because you can tell the disciples are frustrated. And I have to imagine what Jairus is thinking too. He is probably stressed out of his mind. Time is of the essence for his daughter. And Jesus not only stops, but he stops to ask a question that seems ridiculous. Who touched me? I mean, this is a ridiculous question. The disciples effectively say, Jesus, there's a crowd. Who has not touched you here? Let's go. But Jesus is insistent. He wants to know who has touched him. And this woman fesses up. Mark says that she tells him the whole truth. She's frightened. You know, maybe she's worried that Jesus might be mad at her. Also, she's unclean. And if an unclean person touched, I mean, this is another study for another day about just unclean and clean laws and the Old Testament. But if she is an unclean person touched people who were clean, they would become unclean. And so she goes among this crowd of people, probably touching a lot of people just to get to Jesus. I mean, just think of it today. It'd be not exactly the same thing, but you know, if you had COVID and knowingly entered a crowd of people, and then they found out that you went among them knowing you had COVID, they would probably not be happy with you. And so she might be freaked out by that too. That this unclean woman approached a lot of people. But Jesus replies, he wants to speak to her. This is important to him. He stops and replies to her that it wasn't his clothes that healed her. There's nothing magical about the clothes, which she kind of maybe thought there was. But he makes it the point to tell her and the people listening that her faith healed her. And again, you see fear and faith. She's been terrified, and yet she approached him in faith. Jesus didn't want her walking away thinking she had been healed by some magic cloak. He wanted her to know that she was healed by faith in Jesus. Jesus is making an example out of her in the best possible sense, by showing the crowds what faith in him can accomplish. And he commends her for having what he rebuked the disciples for not having back at the end of chapter 4, faith. When he healed the storm, he rebuked the disciples for not having faith. And here he commands this woman for having faith. And he tells her to go in peace. And this is not just like a way to say bye. This isn't just like a see you. By going in peace, he's saying be restored. He didn't just heal her physically. He's restoring her to life in community. He's saying, be restored, be fully reintegrated into the life of the community around you. This is a beautiful thing. I love that he's not just concerned about her physical condition, but her social condition, her isolation, and he restores her back to the community. And so Mark then shifts us back to Jairus. This delay has been great for the woman. It has been horrific and costly for Jairus' daughter. See, in Jairus' mind, as long as his daughter was alive, there was hope for her. And the people approached him from his household, though, and we see that his greatest fear came true. She died. And really, people in his house don't see any point in bothering Jesus anymore. There's nothing he can do. Jesus can do a lot of things, but he can't do anything about this. This is death, okay? You can't bring dead people back. And Mark, again, contrasts fear and faith. Overhearing him talking with the people from his house, he tells Jairus, don't be afraid. Just believe. Don't be afraid. Just believe. And so they go to his house. They continue going. And they arrive. And Jesus says, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. And Jesus knows she's dead, but since sleeping people wake up, he's speaking metaphorically here. And the people laugh at him. Like, you might ask, who's laughing here? These are probably professional mourners. People would often hire out mourners to come when someone died. There would be the family mourning, but also professional mourners hired as well. It might be these people who had no personal attachment to this girl. If it is family, maybe they just think he's being very insensitive here. But he goes into this room. He touches the girl, her hand, which Jews do not touch corpses. They were not to do that. But he touches her hand, and he speaks words in Aramaic. This is probably Mark recalling Peter's memories of this event. And Mark, I think by telling you what Jesus says, he seems to be concerned to show you that what Jesus does is so ordinary here. He's not using these elaborate magical incantations to bring her back from the dead. He just tells her to wake up, and she does. This corpse obeys. This is the most hopeless scenario we've looked at in this section. And yet with ease, once again, Jesus overcomes death itself. And then I love this note about Jesus telling her, telling people to give her food. Because like with the woman he just healed, he's not concerned just for her to not be dead. He's concerned with her. She's probably weak to be restored to full strength. He's concerned that she get food and thus be strengthened again. We see remarkable tenderness from Jesus in this moment. And so Mark, again, is concerned in this section to show us Jesus' authority. And we've seen it in a few ways. We've seen his authority over nature. We've seen his authority over a whole host of demons, a legion of demons. We've seen his authority in healing the woman who'd been sick for 12 years. And then finally, most dramatically, we see his authority in the fact that he brought a little girl back from death. He can even have authority over death. And this is the Jesus we serve today, guys. This is the same Jesus who is at the Father's right hand. Now, he's not physically with us at this moment as he was then. We still die. We still get sick. But we know that Jesus will come back and never leave. And what that means for us is that even though we get sick today, even though we still die, the fact that Jesus is reigning, the fact that he will return means sickness and death are never the last thing in our story. They will one day be in our past. One day we will think of our death as a past tense thing, which is crazy to think about. So we've seen Jesus' power, we've seen his authority, and we've seen just his tenderness too. And we've seen him encourage people not to have fear, but to have faith in him. And that's my prayer for us today, too, that we would look on this guy with faith and pray for him to return and make everything wrong with this world right.